KLL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock. Time to jump here on WILL AM 580. This is Bob McChesney, and you're listening to Media Matters. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been going on for a good decade now, and they seem to be almost endless, like the wars between Oceania and Eurasia in the famous book 1984. Our guest today is one of the few journalists who's really gotten an inside look of how the war was planned and executed from inside the bubble, as he calls it. Our guest is going to be Michael Hastings, a Rolling Stone journalist, talking about his new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. It should be a terrific hour. I hope you join us. But before we go to our guest, here comes Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tavey.
Ever wonder how some of the political ads you're watching can be full of lies and still remain on the air? The Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania has a website for you. FlackCheck.org debunks false political ads and gives you tools to tell your local broadcaster to stop airing them. Kathleen Hall Jamison is the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center and a professor of communications.
Most people don't realize that stations do not have to accept third-party ads. They have to accept federal candidate ads. If they've accepted an ad for one candidate, they have to accept for others, and they can't censor them in any way. But they don't have to air third-party ads. Third-party ads don't have that protection. And what that means is a station can either refuse to air them outright or can insist on their accuracy.
Third-party ads come from super PACs, regular PACs, political parties, or special interest groups. Ads produced by a candidate's campaign are charged the lowest rate, but there's no limit on what broadcasters can charge to air third-party ads. And most ads are third-party ads, which means that broadcasters are making windfall profits this election cycle.
So if they're making all of this money, shouldn't they be more responsible about checking for accuracy since they have the right to do it? And the answer is, well, they have the right to do it, but no legal obligation to do it.
If a candidate is libeled or defamed in a third-party ad, he or she can sue the station. But given the expense of a lawsuit and the time constraints of running a campaign, very few do so. So the public is left with an overwhelming number of attack ads and very little information about what candidates actually stand for. And with big money at stake, there's no chance that the stations will stop airing negative ads. To help remedy the situation, FlackCheck.org wants stations to check the accuracy of the ads before they air. And the initiative is starting to get recognition in some important places. This week, Mike Cavender, the executive director of the Radio Television Digital News Association, praised FlackCheck as an important resource for newsrooms. And a Los Angeles Times editorial endorsed FlackCheck's mission and challenged stations to reject fraudulent political advertisements.
This is a no-cost, non-controversial intervention. What it requires is people taking the time to say, you show me that's accurate before I'm going to air it. So if the biggest, best station in every market, which is the station with the most revenues, you know, were to in every market just say, no, I'm going to insist on accuracy, the super PACs would have to comply because they need that audience.
To learn more, visit www.flackcheck.org.
For the ninth year in a row, the public has ranked PBS the most trusted institution in America, ahead of other forms of media, the courts, and the federal government. The public also overwhelmingly agrees that PBS is an excellent or good use of tax dollars, according to the poll. Two independent, nonpartisan research groups conducted the survey, which was commissioned by PBS. The vote of confidence comes after a difficult year for PBS, which fended off threats to cut its funding. Members of Congress have repeatedly tried to slash funding for public broadcasting. Josh Stearns, the journalism and public media director for Free Press, said the survey should send a strong message to Congress.
Having the survey state, again, 9 years in a row,
that public media is one of the most trusted institutions in America and one of the best expenditures of taxpayer dollars only after the military spending in Department of Defense should send a message to members of Congress that we cannot have any more meddling with public media. And if anything, we need to be talking about expanding what they can do, not cutting their funding.
Many states have also slashed funds or even phased out funding for local PBS stations. Stern says the survey shows that local public broadcasting is essential.
While media consolidation has meant that more and more of the commercial broadcasting has been programmed by people out of state and controlled by companies where we don't even know where their headquarters are, our local PBL stations are still programmed locally, directed locally, and key members of our local communities. And that builds trust like nothing else.
Stern said commercial media simply can't offer the same type of no-strings-attached reporting as public broadcasting.
Now more than ever, entering into an election year where political coverage is going to shape the decisions we make as citizens, we need to have media we can trust that's reporting not just both sides of the story, but all sides of the story. And that's really what public broadcasting does, and one of the reasons it is so trusted. We know that we're getting a story that's mandated and dictated by the needs of the public, not by commercial interests.
The survey results indicate that PBS programming improves literacy rates and provides superior coverage of the arts, science, history, social issues, and other subjects. PBS is also seen as a critical resource for safe and educational programming for children. To read more about the survey, visit SaveTheNews.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. This is Media Matters. Our guest today is a reporter who I've been following for years. Michael Hastings wrote for Newsweek for much of the last decade and has been with Rolling Stone for a few years, covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is still with Rolling Stone, covering international and national politics. And starting this year, he'll be covering the Obama re-election campaign for BuzzFeed. He has a new book out, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan, just published by Blue Rider Press. I've had the privilege of reading the book over the last week. Michael Hastings, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, Bob. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, it's really great to have you. First of all, I just want to say your book is long, and it was daunting when I picked it up and said, oh, I'm going to read this. But it was really a book I could hardly put down. I just sailed right through it. It was very enjoyable and enlightening read. Someone interested in current politics, very interested in Afghanistan and Iraq and foreign policy, and media coverage of war, I'd say this book is on the must-read list.
Thanks so much, and I'm obviously a fan of the show and glad to get the chance to come on and talk about it to your listeners.
Well, let's start with recounting for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the 2010 Rolling Stone cover story that led to General Stanley McChrystal's resignation, which is weaved in this book. It's what the basis of the book book grew out of that. Just a little bit about what that story was and the response to it for some of our listeners who might not recall that episode.
Sure. In June 2010, I published a profile of General Stanley McChrystal, who was then the commanding general of the U.S. And NATO war in Afghanistan. I had spent a month with General McChrystal and his top staff going from Paris to Berlin to Kabul to Kandahar and back to Washington, D.C. After the profile was published, it was quite shocking. There was quite an uproar about it in Washington. General McChrystal was recalled, and it led to his firing. President Obama decided to fire him, basically.
And in the book and in the article, but especially in the book, you build upon it. You've spent a lot of time with General McChrystal and his sort of inner circle of very loyal, devoted aides, what they self-describe as Team America. You call it Inside the Bubble. Could you talk a little bit about what that world was like and how you were able to get access to the world in a way that I don't think any other reporters had in a long time in America and probably won't for a long time?
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, one of the funny things, when I had been asked, like, well, how did you get that access? You know, the thing is, access like that rarely ever happens with anyone of sort of celebrity who has a certain amount of celebrity. It's very difficult to get. And it was probably because I basically asked for it. and they agreed to it, partly because I think Gerald McChrystal wanted to be in Rolling Stone and, to be on the cover of Rolling Stone. I think that was a significant factor. And there were also, with any reporting, you know, you have to be in the wrong place at the right time, and then eventually you're going to be at the right place at the right time in terms of reporting. And I think just the sort of sequence of events that led to me spending a month with them, which I what the book is about, kind of the behind the scenes story about the volcano that went off in Iceland and we got stuck there, and the boozy the road trip from Berlin to Paris and these sorts of things. So that's sort of how the access happened.
Well, as I read the book, what occurred to me were a couple of incidents in journalism history. One was when Joe McGinnis had access to the Nixon campaign in 1968, and back then Roger Ailes was working for Nixon, and he is very close to Ailes. And he sort of saw the inside of the modern political campaign before anyone else, and he was sort of wandering around and really sort of was able to watch everything in a way that would be absolutely impossible after 1968.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in the mid-1990s, you might remember this Michael Moore, God, I make that mistake too often, made a film called The Big One when he's doing a book tour in the 1990s, and he went to Portland, and that's where Nike's headquartered, and Phil Knight, the chair of Nike, his wife is a fan of Michael Moore, so he decided to let Michael Moore interview him to prove how cool he was. And he said all sorts of incredibly awful things. He wanted to sue Michael Moore after the film came out because of what was in it. And that was another episode like this. But what you had was even well beyond that, because you were with, actually, the commanding general of an army in a war with his inner circle, and hearing comments on the president of the United States, the policy of the United States, that I don't know any journalist has heard, again, in decades.
Well, I think one of the things that had happened and why McChrystal and his team were so fascinating kind of characters were that for the first time, really, in military history, you had people coming out of the Special Forces, Green Beret, Navy SEAL, Ranger world who had these huge positions of responsibility during, to run this sort of huge battlefield command. And what that meant was that the culture that these guys cultivated in sort of their day-to-day lives, but also in how, McChrystal commanded, was very different from your traditional sort of army command. Specifically, they were much more fast and loose with the rules. They liked to push the envelope, and they loved risk. I mean, these are the Navy SEALs who sneak down into Pakistan to find bin Laden and jump out of airplanes and swim in, freezing cold water, and special forces guys who live for months, with a knife and eat snakes. And they call them snake eaters. So you have this sort of 10 years of conflict in America. You wind up with these sort of well-trained killers, professional, really, really great soldiers sort of running this thing. But with that comes this sort of cultural side of it that we'd never sort of seen before. So when I recognized this, the portrayals I had seen of General McChrystal and his team and other top generals before in the media, to me, didn't quite add up. I just felt there was something that we were sort of missing there that wasn't being told, and that there might be an opportunity to sort of to show that.
What comes through in the book and in interviews and other pieces you've written is just absolutely what a complete fiasco and error and problem the Afghanistan war is, how indefensible it is, basically by any criteria. It's incoherent and inexcusable. Yet, as you make a clear point in the book, that's not widely understood or really conveyed in the media. I mean, there's just sort of this gap between the reality on the ground one sees in Afghanistan and how it's understood, not just by the public, but even by policymakers in Washington.
Well, this really has come to the fore in recent weeks, too, when you have all sorts of these sort of very strange incidents happening in Afghanistan. But essentially, it's this. Afghanistan is discussed within policy and media circles as if it's reasonable, as if it somehow makes sense that we're doing what we're doing over there, when in fact, everyone also involved knows on a kind of a fundamental gut level that they will tell you in private that it doesn't make sense, and they know it's a waste of resources, and they know it's a waste of lives. They know even the end result, even if they have the most positive end result possible, to compare that with the sort of downsides of what you know one has to do to get to that result isn't even that great. So that's to me, you know, it's not just a book about Afghanistan in a way. I mean, I think it's more of a book about America and Americans and how we. You know, where are we 10 years after September 11th? And I think part of that is, we there's the sort of national, you know, trying to deal with this sort of national psychosis that keeps kind of playing itself out in all sorts of very troubling, disturbing, and costly, both in lives and treasure ways. I mean, I don't know if you've followed the recent Koran burning incident in Afghanistan.
Of course.
But you know, one of the ironies of this is that you have these three American soldiers, apparently, who are going to get disciplined for getting rid of these Korans. And everyone is, but no one is asking the larger question, which is, why are they still in a position where they're confiscating Korans from Afghan prisoners and burning them? I mean, like, we're blaming these low-level people for after we put them in these sort of difficult, impossible situations, without asking the larger question of, like, it seems so absurd that we're even in this position at this point.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Michael Hastings, Rolling Stone reporter, author of the new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan, just published by Blue Rider Press. The phone lines are open today at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. A lot of the book, Michael Hastings, is really a critique of the media's relationship with people in power, and then how they convey debates among elites or don't convey them to the general population. And as I read this book, I thought of an interview I had on this program probably 5 years ago with Robert Fist, the English foreign correspondent who covers the Middle East for the last three or four decades. And Fisk told a story on air. He said that when he was in bars in Beirut or Cairo or Baghdad or wherever he was stationed at the time in the Middle East, he talked to American reporters who invariably knew all sorts of great stuff about what was actually happening in these countries. And then he'd read their reports in the newspaper, see them on TV, and they were vacuous. They had almost, you know, very little of the intelligence that these reporters actually had was demonstrated in the reports. Right. And his point was that something happened in the system of American journalism, sort of wash out the critical content and the really intelligence in it. And that occurred to me as I read your book and saw the way you describe in great detail how the Pentagon and McChrystal specifically and the military in general, the confidence they have that they can sort of get the press to do what they want.
Yeah, no, they have incredible confidence in it, so much so that the scenes I think that really hit home in the book was where General McChrystal is just sort of going through all the different journalists he knows and who've written about him and basically saying, yeah, we spun that guy, we manipulated this guy.
And without tipping any hands, there are some famous journalists on that list.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, if he doesn't like their reporting, you know, what's he going to say about mine? But yeah, what this says, I think there's a lot of truth to that. One of my sort of philosophies of reporting that I sort of say, and it's a little more, this is true, is that if you report what everyone knows but no one is saying or no one is writing, then you know that's significant, right? Because there's always a reason. If a group, especially among the media or political class, if everyone knows in this sort of elite world knows something. But yet that's not becoming public. Why isn't that? And just by the act of making that public, that is news to the wide majority of people. So I think there is something. And I've had, I started my career at Newsweek magazine in 2002. And one of the reasons I left Newsweek was that I felt invariably every story I did, the most interesting details I had would get cut. And so it's exactly as Fisk, was sort of talking about. I don't know what particularly the Beirut coverage he was talking about, but there is this sort of systematic way of leaching really critical stuff from your material. That being said, if you do read the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, every day, the information's there. I mean, really, like, everything is sort of there, but it often is just also how it's presented and what is emphasized and what's not. That's part of it, too.
One of the other things, Michael Hastings, you just say in passing, actually, in the book, but it was quite striking at a couple points you talk about this. One was on how General Petraeus, when he was the head of command in Iraq, Iraq was very able to successfully portray the surge as, you know, probably one of the greatest military victories since D-Day. And on one hand, but then you just say in passing, of course, it wasn't anything like that at all on the ground in Iraq. It was, you know, but, you know, we have this complete chasm, 180-degree difference. Explain that, would you, to our listeners who probably think the surge was this great military victory in Iraq?
Yeah, the surge, the success of the surge was that it temporarily lowered violence in Iraq to a level that was acceptable to American policymakers, so they could say to themselves, well, we didn't get run out of town, right? That is its essential success. But there's a lot of buts and caveats that go along with that. First, what was the cost to us of lowering the violence to sort of an acceptable level? The cost was siding with one side in a religious civil war, right? We sided with the Shiite government, and we basically armed what amounted to death squads. And we fought a brutal, extremely violent campaign where we helped one side win. So that's what we did. So if you actually look at what we did there, it's not as glorious thing as it's portrayed. And you know, also, you know, the larger theory of the surge was that the reason we were going to expend all this energy and blood to lower the violence and to back this one side is because that would then lead to enough breathing room for a political solution. And that just hasn't happened. You know, it hasn't happened, and maybe it will happen 20 years from now. Maybe it will happen 10 years from now. But once you start getting into that, looking that much forward and predicting events and what caused what, you're on pretty shaky ground.
You know, Michael Hastings, a lot of people, and I would count myself as one of them, are confused about exactly what the status of all these wars is.
Yeah.
You know, we're told the war in Afghanistan is winding down. The war in Iraq is apparently over, but we apparently have an embassy there that is roughly the size of Detroit,
yeah.
You know,
huge.
With untold numbers of troops and private contractors still hanging around in the country, far more than we have in most places in the world. So are we at peace, and what's going on in those countries today?
Well, I think the calculation is, are Americans dying in these countries, right? In terms of how Americans view the war and how much attention it gets in the press, it all depends on how many casualties there are from the American side of things. So in the Iraq case, yes, for America, the Iraq war is essentially over. We don't have ground troops there. We have a huge, as you said, a huge embassy, a lot of contractors, but you're not going to see a large number of American soldiers getting killed. Now, if you're an Iraqi, the war is not over. If you're an Iraqi, there's still this ongoing civil war that had dropped the levels of violence have dropped, and now it goes back up again. I mean, if you look at the numbers in Iraq over the past couple months, there's been really significant violence there. If it happened in any other country, we'd clearly say, oh yeah, there's a pretty serious war going on. But because, you know, we want to pretend that the war's over, we don't say that. But clearly that's what's happening in Iraq. In Afghanistan, you know, it's sort of absurd paradox where we're saying the war is over or the war is winding down, but that means there's going to be three more years of pretty intense fighting before we get to that point. So that's the sort of tragedy at this stage of the game with Afghanistan. I mean, it brings to mind, you know, young John Kerry's famous quote, how can you ask the last soldier to die in Vietnam? We've now entered that phase in Afghanistan where, you know, how do you, since we all know that basically it's winding down, that by 2014, barring some sort of radically unforeseen event, we are going to be leaving and leaving behind a kind of similar sort of situation as we did in Iraq, perhaps with more special forces behind. So how do you justify 3 more years of doing something that, you know, everyone has kind of already given up on?
And then, of course, sandwiched between those two countries is Iran, which is now in the crosshairs of the political elite in Washington and elsewhere. As you look at Iran, how do you see this in the flow of events of the last decade in American foreign policy?
Well, I think what's going on now with Iran is extremely disturbing in light of the fact that we're just kind of getting out of Iraq and we're still engaged in a pretty significant war in Afghanistan for a number of years forward. Where does it fit in terms of American foreign policy? Clearly, you know, Iran, like Cuba, is one of these states we've had this sort of longstanding vendetta with. And I think we are now getting to a point, because the discourse, the rhetoric is so heated, it's moving us closer and closer and closer to what proponents of the war want to be an inevitable military action. From folks and sources that I speak to within the Obama administration, they don't really want that. They do not want a military attack on Iran. They do not want Israel to attack Iran. They do not want us to get involved in Iran. There are people within the military who do not, significant portion, who do not want us to get involved in some sort of situation with Iran for all sorts of reasons. But what we've seen happen, remember when President Obama took power, he said he was going to negotiate with Iran, right? That was sort of the promise. I'm going to start negotiating with our enemies, you know? And that then shifted, so the debate was whether to negotiate or sanctions. And then it became sanctions or attack, and now it seems like the debate is narrowing to what kind of attack we're going to pull off. Is it Israel who's going to attack, or are we going to attack? It's been quite disturbing, and you see the media sort of respond in the same way that they did with the Iraq war. And the response is going to be, well, yeah, but Iran is different.
Iran is different, but it strikes me that it's different not in the ways they're saying, but rather different in the sense that it's a much more larger and substantial adversary than Iraq was, or certainly Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think my sort of take on it is that if we've learned anything from the Arab Spring, it's that our best bet in terms of actually bringing positive change to the Middle East, in so much we view ourselves as that's our role, we're much better off letting, you know, homegrown democratic movements do it on their own. We have to really think carefully about any strike against Iran. What's that going to do with the democracy movement in Iran and the dissidents in Iran and the people who we would want to see running Iran from Washington's perspective? And I think that's a really significant question. I'm not an expert on it, so it's so hard to predict. But generally, you know, when your country starts getting bombed by an enemy, that's not going to help the moderates, right? Mm-hmm. Once you enter into military action, and once you unleash the dogs of war, and once different, you know, once you start using enough violence against a country that their society starts to break apart, the moderates, the people we want to see in charge, the people whose viewpoints are critical for democracy to actually take root in the Middle East, those are the first people who are going to be dead. Those are the people who are going to be exiled. They're the ones who are going to get killed. And that to me is also fairly disturbing.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Michael Hastings from Rolling Stone, author of the new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. The phone lines are open at 217-333-9455, and toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to line 4, Coles County. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Michael Hastings.
Yes, I thought I would mention that I know a guy in Mattoon who is a member of the Illinois Army National Guard, and he spent a year in Afghanistan as a member of the Illinois Army National Guard, and that was about a year or two ago. And I talked to him a few months ago, and he says that he believes the U.S. should pull out of Afghanistan, totally and completely withdraw from Afghanistan. This is particularly significant, I think, because this guy is a conservative. There's no question he's definitely conservative. He's no liberal, that's for sure. And he told me that before he went to Afghanistan, people told him that it was just like Vietnam, the same kind of situation. And, of course, at that time, he was sure they were wrong. He disagreed with them 100%. And after being in Afghanistan for a year, he says that he, of course, knows that they were absolutely correct and agrees with them now totally. So I just thought I would mention that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Michael, in the book, The Legacy of Vietnam and the Lessons of Vietnam loom heavily over the military and the policymakers. And, for one thing, just to follow up on the caller's comments, you know, you get the chance to see rank and file, too, on the ground in both Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, was what he says not surprise you? And then talk also about Vietnam.
No, it's a great, your caller's absolutely right. What's interesting, he made the point of saying that his friend was a conservative. And it's a great point as well, because you can look through all my reporting on Afghanistan, and I almost invariably only quote people who are conservative, because there is absolutely nothing conservative about a $120 billion a year nation-building campaign in Afghanistan. It is the opposite of actual sort of conservative value that as they're allegedly supposed to be. And it's not because I don't like liberals or don't think they're smart. That's not why I don't quote them. It's because I think it adds a credibility when you quote military guys who, in general, are quite conservative, sort of talking about this stuff, as the caller suggested his friend in the National Guard did. And I would also point out that of all the times I've spent with American troops, guys who are fighting, really fighting out on the streets every day, out in these fields, getting shot at, getting blown up, having to do these missions, I would say, you know, the people who were supportive of what they were doing, of like actually believed in like that this was a worthwhile endeavor, and this is true for both Iraq and Afghanistan, was the minority. The majority of actual soldiers, they might love what they're doing and they love the job and they love serving their country, but if you talk to them for any length of time about, you know, what they're really accomplishing or if it's worthwhile or if it's making America safer, the majority from my experience, will tell you no.
Michael Hastings, we're going to talk a little bit more about the media now and some of the stuff you have in the book about the sort of information campaigns and perception management and public relations that the military and the government works on to influence how wars are understood. But before we go there, just provide sort of a view for the side of journalism. A couple of weeks ago, a New York Times journalist named Anthony Shadid died. You knew Anthony. He was a student of mine, actually, when I taught at the University of Wisconsin. Wow. And you wrote a glowing tribute to him. And I just, you know, for the sake of people who think all we do is bash journalism on this program, talk a little bit about what Anthony's work was and how it was distinguished from the PAC journalism of the Iraq in that period, in that era, zone.
Sure. I mean, Anthony was incredible. I had the privilege of spending about a month with him in Baghdad when he was at the Washington Post at the time, and I was there living in a hotel next door. And he was someone who had, when my McChrystal story did come out, and there was a lot of criticism from some in the press, Anthony was one of the few in that world who sent me very supportive notes and emails and had my back. And for that, you know, I was always incredibly, incredibly grateful to have that sort of voice. What made Anthony so unique, exactly, he didn't follow the pack. He had the confidence in his craft to write what he, to write, you know, to get as close to writing the truth as possible as he saw it. And he wasn't afraid to do that. And he did it in a way that was so, he did this in this incredible way that was so, on the one hand, sort of very poetic, but also extremely informative, that even those he criticized, appreciated it in a way that I don't know necessarily can be the same case, can say the same for some of the writing I do. But that's what made him unique. And remember, Anthony didn't, he wasn't one of these guys who was gung-ho about invading Iraq. But what he did do was go out on his own and tell the stories of Iraqis and tell the stories of Americans. And he did that again and again and again over the years And that's, you know, I mean, it's such a loss to journalism and to just to the general sort of. I mean, it's just a loss. It's a huge, huge loss.
I couldn't agree more. Let's go back to the phone lines now. To line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with Michael Hastings, author of The Operators.
Hi. I thought I had a moment to collect some things here, but Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, I think you're chronicling his story, and he's sort of a whistleblower, and I don't know what other media outside the alternative are actually making a case about what he's come back and said. But I have to also say something about what else must be at stake in Afghanistan and AFPAC for us to be ignoring, perhaps, or dismissing these concerns. And I think it has to do with geopolitics. The House of Representatives has got into looking into Pakistan's internal affairs by passing a Free Baluchistan sort of resolution. It doesn't have force of law, I don't think, but it sort of goes along with this whole idea that the Republican House is, and I don't want to partisanize it too much because I see a lot of this on both sides, is getting into internal dynamics in that region. So I just think that the whole area is still the grand chessboard or the great game, and the U.S., is looking at pipelines and, you know, getting down on Pakistan for agreeing to this latest pipeline deal. And I just think that given the way you're reporting it and the military situation, we have to look for another cause, another reason. And I think that, all right, well, that's enough to satisfy my approach.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Any comments, Michael Hastings?
Sure. I mean, Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis, he is a whistleblower, 17-year Army veteran, who a few weeks ago told his story to the New York Times. He'd been in Afghanistan. It was his second tour. He came back and he wrote a devastating report, two reports actually, one classified, one unclassified, sent it around to members of Congress as well, submitted to the Pentagon before he went public. A couple days after he talked to the Times, I obtained a copy of one of his reports, and we posted it online at Rolling Stone. Essentially his essential argument, and Davis would put it differently and more elegantly, but essentially he said almost every claim that the senior military leadership has made about our progress in Afghanistan has been false, and not only has it been false, they have data that at the time that showed it was false, but they made these claims anyway. So that's pretty significant because it's not coming from some Joe off the street. It's not coming from me. It's coming from a 17-year Army vet who just returned from Afghanistan. So there's that. As in terms of the other interests that are involved with what we're really doing and why we're really there, We come up. I find that to be one of the toughest questions. I think in many cases all sorts of interests converge, but I don't think we're in Afghanistan because of a pipeline deal, and I don't think we're in Pakistan necessarily for those sorts of reasons. Are they part of the reasons we're there? Sure, but I think there's something, and I have a very difficult time explaining what exactly is, besides saying there's this sort of systematic. Sort of once the wheels of the Pentagon get turning to go on some sort of adventure as they did in Afghanistan, it's very hard to kind of dial that back, right? Because the question and the other thing is why when we ask the question why are we in Afghanistan, the answer they come back with invariably, by they I mean you know the administration, the Pentagon, is because we're hunting terrorists because that makes us safer, right? Now, that is demonstrably basically false for large part. There are some we get occasional bad guy, but the strategy we're pursuing, which is to have 150,000 NATO troops there, 120 billion a year nation building, that doesn't help us get those guys who are supposed to be a threat to us. And in fact, one can pretty convincingly argue that in fact doesn't even make us safer. So then the question is, well, then what are we really doing there? But part of it is I think they convince themselves that the reasons they tell us, which we know are not necessarily true, are the actual reasons. And you're right, they get into this real politic thing that, oh, you don't understand. You know, we have to project our power everywhere. We have to sort of keep people in line to protect, you know, our global interests. So those are all reasons, too. We have to show we're not weak. We can't just leave. You know, that would be a victory for us. So they come up with all sorts of justifications to sort of continue along these paths.
Michael Hastings, it seems that as I read your book, it's such an important part of it when you're discussing McChrystal, in particular Petraeus, but it really applies to the entire sort of military national security complex now, is this sort of notion of perception management or information war, that controlling what people think is the first and most important battle you have, even more important than what actually takes place on the ground, it seems like. And I was astounded as I read your book to see the data that the Pentagon has 21,000 public relations people, that there are $4.7 billion spent on public relations annually in the Pentagon, that, you know, a leading general, a top general, will have a staff of maybe six PR people, spinmeisters, working with them.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't think most Americans are quite familiar with just exactly that we've just got this enormous PR thing going on.
Oh, it's massive. I mean, there is a constant information, I'll call it an information operation campaign for the consumption of the American public. And one of the sort of interesting things about Vietnam, and you'd asked that earlier, I didn't quite get to it, is that General David Petraeus, who's the legendary, mythic general of our time, wrote his 1987 doctoral PhD about Vietnam. And one of the things he said was that it's not what happens that matters. It's what policymakers think that happens that matters. And he said the key is perception, right? So, you know, he sort of makes this observation in passing, but then you see how it actually plays out in these wars, because clearly the lesson of Vietnam was not to get involved. You would think the lesson of Vietnam was not to get involved in, you know, long, drawn-out guerrilla wars in foreign countries that we don't understand. So don't even get involved. I mean, that is a sort of conventionally wisdom of what the true lesson of Vietnam is. But what was sort of the military has done over the past few years was to say, no, the lesson of Vietnam is, if you're going to do this, you know, make sure it doesn't affect a large swath of the American public, you know, because you only have like 1% who are in part of this volunteer army. And B, keep telling everyone we're winning, you know, and just keep telling everyone you're winning, and do it in a way that seems somewhat credible. And if the actual American population is not being affected by it, then you can continue doing these things for years to come.
And in your book, you coin a term. I've seen it elsewhere, but I'll give you credit for it now: the media military industrial complex. And you talk about how after your Rolling Stone piece came out in 2010 that led to McChrystal being fired and his resignation, that the response of other journalists, by and large, and you mentioned Anthony Shadid as the exception, was really critical of you, although the story, as I hasten to point out, was quadruple fact-checked and there was no error ever found in the veracity of what you reported.
Well, in fact, and most of the reporters, even those who criticized me, agreed with what I was writing.
Yeah, right? And they even agreed with you.
Yeah. So it was a funny thing. Now, I think in the original story there was sort of this implicit criticism of the media, and the criticism was, you know, you've been hearing this sort of narrative of McChrystal and the larger narrative of the war, and it hasn't actually been accurate, right? And this was sort of implicit within the story. In the book, you know, the story was called The Runaway General. The book is really about the runaway military. And part of that is the sort of behavior of the Pentagon press corps and other journalists whose livelihoods depend on it. I made it explicit. I called them out for what I think is just you know, look, if they want to do it, that's their business. But the major insight is this: it's called the Pentagon Press Corps for a reason, and that's because they're the press corps for the Pentagon. And that sounds like a clever, or maybe doesn't that sound that clever? That, you know, that sounds like a soundbite, but it's also, in my experience, actually the truth. And in fact, these reporters begin to identify more with the organizations that they cover, this sort of bubble mentality, and they forget that their responsibility, or don't care that their responsibility, in my mind, should always be towards the readers. And they get pissed when I say this. But you know, every time I've just seen it. Not only have I seen it happen kind of systematically with the larger stories, I've seen it happen with me personally and how they have covered, the McChrystal resignation, the McChrystal story, and they've sort of responded to my work.
You're sort of the Lutheran minister who goes in the whorehouse. You're no fun to have around.
Yeah, apparently.
This leads really to a piece, a story you've been covering too and working on, which is WikiLeaks and what they've done. You interviewed Julian Assange. You just had a recent piece up on how the government, the Department of Homeland Security, was spying on Occupy Wall Street using WikiLeaks released data. And I think this really is part of the narrative you've just been laying out, Michael Hastings, because, you know, WikiLeaks has been extraordinarily controversial among working journalists. You would think, in theory, would be elated to have accessed all this material.
This is one of the most head-scratching WikiLeaks thing that's around. One of the reasons I got the interview with Assange was that while WikiLeaks was getting so criticized in the United States, I was one of the few journalists who actually went on television. I think Glenn Greenwald did as well, and there were a few to defend them. To say, like, wait a second, guys, like, you know, this is not an espionage organization. You know, these guys are doing sort of publishing. They're doing it in a way that's definitely radical and different and may not make us comfortable. And there might be they might be doing things that we don't approve of. But at the end of the day, what they're doing is quite a significant should be of quite significant interest to journalists in a way that should be more positive than how they're being portrayed from a journalist perspective, right? Like, what journalist would not jump for joy at having access to 250,000 State Department cables, right? I mean, it's one of the most incredible troves of information in modern that you could even imagine getting access to. The same thing. So that's how. So you know, the reason I wanted to go talk to Assange was that, you know, it's been a year he was under house arrest. And to just sort of allow him to sort of speak warts and all about what he viewed as their role in journalism, but as well as, you know, his experience working with various journalists here. And the same thing happened with their WikiLeaks recent disclosure of 5 million emails that they're starting to release. It was immediate. WikiLeaks said on last Sunday night, we are going to start releasing 5 million emails from this private intelligence firm. And the immediate response from establishment journalists in Washington was, oh, dismiss it, ignore it, this is no big deal. And I just thought that was just such a strange response. I mean, well, here are 5 million emails. Maybe there's something in them, maybe there's not. But don't we want to look? I mean, isn't it our job to sort of say, like, well, let's make an informed decision at the very least? So why is there this knee-jerk response? I can understand why the government wants to dismiss it. The U.S. government or these corporations want to dismiss it. But why would journalists not? And I think at the end of the day, and I'm going on and on about this, but I'll try to.
Well, it's a show on media, so you're allowed to.
Yeah. At the end of the day, the establishment journalist and the establishment government official they're of the same. I mean, they're of the same cloth, I think, in a lot of cases, and there's both sort of culturally, socially, that to me, I think, is the only thing that truly.
And you point out in the book that there are a number of journalists who cross over to work for the Pentagon or some sort of military interest, journalists who specialize in national security, so they become known to those sort of folks, and so it gets awfully chummy at that level.
Oh, sure, and you have, you know, the Pentagon correspondent, New York Times, was paid by a leading think tank, a leading, you know, defense contractor funded think tank, you know, while he was still doing stuff for the Times, and you go through the list, almost every major Pentagon correspondent working for a major American newspaper has been on the payroll. Either from money or support from organizations and think tanks that are funded by the defense contractors and in many ways, you know, Department of Defense, because they often fund the defense contractors. And this is sort of acceptable, and it's not considered unusual or in bad form. And so you have situations where, you know, the journalists are sharing offices with generals and retired generals, you know? Mm-hmm. And chummy is the exact word. So that by the very nature of it, because we're human, that's going to mute one's criticism.
Our guest, Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, new book out with Blue Rider Press. He also writes for Rolling Stone and also going to be covering the 2012 election for BuzzFeed. Michael Hastings, you know, when I read this book, a way that you deal with Obama in your own assessment as it appears, but also in the assessment certainly of McChrystal and most of the military people, is not especially flattering as a leader. In fact, it's not unlike Ron Suskind's presentation of Obama on economic matters. He doesn't come across as an especially forceful leader, one who's really feels he has the ability to stand up and take a strong stand against entrenched interest. Tell me if I'm getting that right, and then sort of you're going to cover this campaign now. What is your measure of him after 3.5 years in office?
Well, I think there's two issues. I mean, what's funny is that some people have read it and said I was too easy on President Obama. Others have said, I was hard on him. You know, my feeling, it's funny. I came around on President Obama I think Afghanistan was his biggest foreign policy mistake by far. I think it was a huge, huge error to escalate that they did in Afghanistan. But at the end of the day, after reporting on it and thinking about it, I developed a measure of sort of sympathy might be the wrong word, and I don't think the president would care if I have sympathy for his decision-making process or not, but sympathy of all the different factors that he had to face as a first year in office, no prior military experience, you know, economy going to hell, healthcare trying to pass, and someone whose prime focus, you know, is not really, you know, wasn't really foreign policy, though in fact he obviously won on this sort of anti-war tide. But what I started thinking, if, in an alternative universe, President Obama wanted to sort of say, no, we're done in Afghanistan, I'm going to shut the war down, could he have done that in his first year? Would it have been possible for any president to have done that in their first year? And I don't know. I just honestly don't know if that's even possible. Like, you need Ron Paul you need someone like who is willing to stake their political life on withdrawing from Afghanistan or on ending this war. And no one is going – you're not going to find a president who's going to do that. You know, that's just – and that's for all sorts of reasons. And the sort of cruel, you know, and this is what the cruel irony of it all is that though, you know, these politicians are not willing to stake their political lives to end the war, they don't mind sending other people – over to lose their lives to fight the war because they don't have the political courage to end it. So I think that's a valid criticism. I think I over time, though, as I said, I've grown, you know, more appreciative, I guess, of the constraints in terms of what's possible. but we'll have to see. I mean, I think Woodward, Susskind. In my book as well, it's a pretty consistent picture. And if you read recent profiles of the president and the Atlantic and the New Yorker, it's a pretty consistent. We sort of know what his leadership style is, right? It's not necessarily kind of the traditional way that one would look at it.
You know, one of the things I really liked about your book, Michael Hastings, was that you sort of give an inside look at the military that Americans rarely get, especially if you're not, you know, and now, as you point out in the book, the military is really segregated from the vast majority of the people of the country. The draft isn't there. Most people aren't serving in the military. They aren't military families, the majority of people. So the military is sort of the separate sphere that fights these wars, but doesn't really affect you directly, and especially if the taxes don't get raised to pay for these wars. And, you know, What is it? You know, just talk a little bit, if you would, about what Americans who aren't connected to the military should know about it. What's going on there that people would be surprised to learn?
Well, I think this is, you know, look, so my younger brother was in the military. He was a captain, an infantry platoon leader, and I've been intimately involved as a journalist and a writer and personally in these wars for the past number of years, and have seen, you know, people I've loved died and friends and everything like that. And see, so I have had a real connection, and I talk to soldiers all the time, connection to these things. What the major issue is in terms of having this kind of chasm between those who served and those who didn't is that we have, for those of us who haven't served and don't have experience with them, a tendency to sort of mythologize what it actually means to be in the military, right? There's a lot of heroes in the military, a lot of people doing amazing things, a lot of really talented, really smart people who are doing incredible things, but there's also a lot of them who aren't, right? And this was a criticism that if you go back and you read Norman Mailer, or you read James Jones, or you read Paul Fussell, great World War II historian, they will all say, or you read any of the guys who were in Korea or Vietnam, because there was a much greater intermingling among civilian and military, there wasn't this, there was a more accurate view of what these institutions really were. And that was somewhat of a constraint on military action, right? But now, because they're sort of protected, and for good reason, you know, but there's a lot of, I'm not trying to be too critical here, but because they're sort of protected by this chasm and these sort of myths we've built up around and our own guilt for not serving, they're able to use that to sort of do things and not get criticized for them in the way that a politician or anyone else would get criticized for.
And I think as a historian, I can say that as the founders and framers of the Republic were definitely concerned about precisely that sort of chasm emerging. You know, the other thing that jumped out in the book, Michael Hastings, that I sort of knew, but I hadn't really thought about, but it became crystal clear as I read about Petraeus and McChrystal and some of the other generals, is what a significant percentage of our leading generals and military leaders come from military families, and their fathers and grandfathers were generals as well. You know, it almost seemed like a royal lineage.
Right. You know, it's a very specific, unique culture that's totally alien to how most of us live our lives. I mean, it really is, and it goes, and in some cases, generations. General Caldwell, who I read about, his father was a general. General Petraeus, his father-in-law was a general. General McChrystal's father was a general. You go down the list. A lot of these generals who are on McChrystal's staff, their kids are at West Point. There's a lot of positives to that. You could argue, you know, you have this sort of professional military class. That has this sort of institutional knowledge and experience, and it's passing down from one generation to another, and those things, you know, one could view as quite positive, but you know, again, you know, any sort of isolated society is going to have their own sort of, you know, customs and rules, and I think it doesn't serve any of us to allow that chasm to exist, certainly in the way it does now.
On that note, Michael Hastings, yeah. Unfortunately, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background.
Yeah.
Because they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you, Michael Hastings, so much for taking an hour out of your Sunday to talk to us about your new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. And I hope you take time to join us again in the future and report on the campaign trail.
Yeah, we'd love to. Love the show. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Sure thing, Michael. Thank you. And I want to thank Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with another show. I look forward to seeing you then. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
There's a slight chance of snow today with mostly cloudy skies, the high 38 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a slight chance of snow, the low 25. Mostly sunny tomorrow, the high 38, mostly clear skies. Tomorrow night, the low 28. Very windy Tuesday, not as cold. Sunny skies, the high 58. Wind gusts up to 45 miles an hour. Not as cold Tuesday night, partly cloudy, the low 45. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM